Good morning. We're going to continue talking about Jesus as Lord and the significance of that title as found in the Gospel of Mark. And today, our kind of secondary theme we want to discuss is the idea, you might have guessed, of hope. In particular, I want to ask, what do Christians mean by hope? And what does it have to do with Jesus being Lord? I think they're tightly tied together. But first, you got to think about what does the word hope even mean. To the cynic, the word hope is at best just, you know, the power of positive thinking, a way of deciding to see the world. The glass is half full instead of half empty. It didn't change anything. It's just the way you chose to see it. It's just a word game. You decide it's half full instead of half empty. So for the cynic, you know, at best, that's what it is. At worst, it's self-delusion. Hopeful people are just, you know, lying to themselves. For the cynic, you know, I get it. If you get $10 in your bank account and you hope it'll cover a $100 transaction, you're not hopeful, you're delusional, right? It's not a power of positive thinking issue there. It's a matter of math. And numbers work, and it's not going to work out for you, okay? Not a question of hope. So the cynic looks at the Christian and basically thinks that's how we're living our whole lives. We've all got $10 in the bank, and we're trying to cash $100 checks with our lives, right? Only instead of checks, it's prayers. The cynic looks at the Christian and says, you want things to be different, and you tell God you want things to be different, and then you expect things to be different, and you're delusional, right? So that's how the cynic sees hope. What I want to suggest to you today is that's not the meaning of hope. It's not the meaning of hope in the Bible. The cynic has a point, but not a good one. And I think there's something to be learned about the lordship of Christ and the doctrine of hope, especially in a particular set of stories told in Mark chapter 5. In Mark chapter 5, verses 21 through 22, the story begins, as a lot of stories in Mark do. There's a big crowd, and Jesus is traveling, and then something happens. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet. So the first thing we notice is that there's this individual. There's going to be two very different individuals introduced to us in the sequence of stories. So notice the details about the first one. We have a man. He has a name. His name is Jairus, spelled out for us. And he is a ruler of the synagogue. There we go. He's a powerful man. Okay. The synagogue is kind of the center of cultural life in a small Jewish town, and this guy's in charge of it. He's a powerful person. And yet on this occasion, he comes in with this crowd and he falls at the feet of a peasant. By societal standards, Jesus isn't the ruler of anything. We say Jesus is Lord, but again, the cynic looks at Jesus and sees a traveling peasant. Jesus isn't the ruler of anything. He's not in charge of anything. He's just this man with notoriety traveling from place to place. And yet here is Jairus, and he's a powerful person, and he comes and he falls at the feet of Jesus, making known a request. And the request is recorded for us in verses 23 through 24. And he implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him, and a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. What do we know? The situation is grim. The man has a daughter. He calls my little daughter. Okay, that's a tender command. He may be a powerful man, but the little girl's got dad wrapped around his finger, right, her finger. She, his little girl. And she is, as it says, at the point of death. So the first thing I'd want to comment about this man and his hope is this is not a person who's naive. He might be desperate. In fact, I would say he probably is. He's not naive. He's not deluded. Delusion is when you say, "My daughter's not sick. She's fine. Everything's fine." I love, one of my favorite internet memes is the picture of the little dog next to the building's on fire and the house is on fire, and he's just sitting there with his cup of coffee and he says, "Everything's fine. Everything's fine," right? That's self-delusion. That's sitting next to the dumpster fire and saying, "No, this is fine." He's not doing that. He's not saying the doctors are wrong. He's not deluded. He is aware that he has a very real problem, and denial won't change it. He may be desperate, but he's not naive. And so he presumably has done all the normal things you do when someone is facing a life-threatening illness. This is a powerful man. He has no limitation of resources, I suspect. And so anything that an average ruler of a synagogue could afford, he could afford. He'd gone and done all those things, and still she's at the point of death. He may be desperate because what has happened so far hasn't worked out, but he's not naive. He's not deluded. He comes to Jesus with a very real problem, desperate for help. And he's acted on that. And so Jesus, based on that, comes along with him, and they meander down the road. Now, at this point, Mark does something that Mark, as a storyteller, is actually famous for. If you read the Gospel of Mark, Mark likes to start a story and then interrupt it. If you're a parent, you're familiar with this storytelling mechanism. Children use it all the time. They start, and then you go over here, and then you're over here, and then you're over there, and then you're back to, and then I went to bed, right? And you kind of have to follow it. Mark's is a little more organized than that. It's not quite, chain of consciousness. It's a little more, not improv, it's thoughtful. But he will start a story and then interrupt it and say, while that was happening, this was happening. And then after the other story, he'll come back to the original. And there's always a connection between the chunk in the middle and the pieces on the outside. There's always a connection. Something happened on the way to the man's house, and Mark wants to tell us. And what he wants to do is introduce to us our second character. This is verses 25 through 26. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. I want you to pause a moment and notice all the ways this woman is different from our man Jairus. They are, in storytelling terms, polar opposites. Okay? Let me start with the obvious. What is her name? We don't get that woman. Right, there was a woman. We don't get a name. Sick woman number one is how she's listed in the credits at the end of the movie. She doesn't get a name. Jairus has a name, okay? Maybe it's not real important. He's a man. She's a woman. In the ancient world, and to some degree in our world today, that makes a difference in how the story plays out, okay? Furthermore, Jairus is powerful. He's a ruler of the synagogue. This woman is the ruler of nothing. In fact, because of her illness, she is unclean. Blood-related illnesses, there's whole chunks of the book of Leviticus dedicated to this point that blood-related illnesses made you unclean, and she's got one. The text doesn't give you a lot of details of, because even today, and this is to tell you how well this story works, even today we're a little uncomfortable talking about the illness, right? There is some kind of blood-related problem that a woman has. And already the preacher says, I don't want to say any more about that. See? So it's an uncomfortable story. She has this illness. So whereas we have a man who's ruling the synagogue, we have a woman who's unclean and might not have been welcome there. See how they're very different? He presumably had resources. She might have had resources at one point, but not anymore. Why? Because she had spent all that she had. This wasn't an acute illness. The ruler Jairus has a daughter who's at the point of death, presumably had set on very quickly. Hers, on the other hand, 12 years. 12 years. You guys had a long-term illness before? Illness makes everything longer. Okay? That year, Celine had cancer. Longest year of our lives, right? I wasn't even sick. Longest year of our lives. It seemed like it went on and on and on, and it was just a year. I mean, really, it wasn't even a full year in that sense. 12 years of dealing with this particular illness over and over again. And in fact, as the text tells us, nothing had worked. This woman is sick, she's unclean, she's poor. People had taken advantage of her, presumably. Either intentionally, they'd said, yeah, I've got a cure for that, and taken her money, or she had simply been failed by the powerful. The people that said they had answers said, well, take your money, and then it didn't work. Whether it was nefarious or not, we don't know, but the outcome was the same. She was still sick, and we're just left to imagine the things she had been through. There is an old Methodist commentator by the name of Clark. It's an outdated commentary, but once in a while, if you dig through there, you can find a little nugget of some information that only he knew, because he was one of those guys who just knew stuff. And he, in this story, references, if I'm remembering correctly, he references some Jewish documents he had read through. I have no idea what it was, but it's ancient remedies for blood-related conditions. It'll curl your toes, the stuff that was the best practice of the day that she might have been inflicted with, including but not limited to just trying to frighten her. Like, woman has a discharge of blood. If you go behind her and scare her and yell really loud, it might dry it up. This is in the literature, right? And Clark says, this is the kind of stuff. She might have paid somebody for that. You think about that? You gave somebody money. He says, yeah, I've got a cure. Walk over there, turn around. Boo! That'll be $5.99, right? That's the kind of life she was living in desperation and had spent all of her wealth, whatever she had, meager or otherwise, trying to get better. And she had been failed time and time again. So I hope what you want to see is two characters, and in terms of storytelling, polar opposites. And yet they have one thing in common. They have a problem they can't fix. They have a problem they can't fix. And so both of them come to Jesus. The text tells us in verses 35, I'm sorry, this is in Matthew, and Matthew's rendition of the story of Jesus, it mentions something that I wanted to kind of add in here, that Jesus was famous for a particular kind of healing. In the life of Jesus, there are numerous examples, apparently, where people just got close enough to Jesus to touch him, and they got better. Okay, so here's Matthew's account, chapter 14, 35 and 36. And when the men of that place recognized him, they sent around to all that region and brought to him all who were sick and implored him that they might only touch the fringe of his garment, and as many as touched it were made well. Luke tells us the same piece of information in Luke chapter 6, verse 19. And all the crowd sought to touch him, for power came out from him and healed them all. There's a little detail that's just kind of mentioned in the Gospels like you're supposed to know it, that one of the things Jesus was famous for was not simply working miracles, but being a miracle, being a walking, talking incarnation of power and healing, such that he could walk through and people in faith reach out and touch him, and they would be made well simply by that act of faith. Okay, so that's well known in Matthew, it's mentioned in Luke. And so in Mark, this woman is aware of that story, that sort of story about Jesus. So in Mark chapter 5, 27 to 28, she decides to give that a shot. It says, she had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, if I touch even his garments, I will be made well. So as we started out by saying what is hope not, now I want us to start thinking about what is hope. And the first thing I want to say that distinguishes hope from either naivety or despair is that hope is characterized by action. If you are naive and you keep telling yourself nothing's wrong, nothing's wrong, nothing's wrong, nothing's wrong, you don't act. Right? If you think you're not sick, you don't go to the doctor. If you have despair, you don't act. If you say, I'm sick and no one can help me, I'm sick and no one can help me, you also don't go to the doctor, right? Interesting thing, on both ends of the spectrum, if you are naive or in despair, both of those cases give you a reason not to do anything. You don't act. Hope results in action. If you believe there's hope, if you believe something could be different, if you think the outcome could be good instead of what it is, then you're willing to act accordingly. And again, we have special names for that kind of action. We call it desperation. We say, that person's desperate. But in the Bible, I think what you're seeing here and that is hope, a belief, a sincere belief, not that the world is good, but that it could be. That it could be different. That things could be made right. I can't promise you that every time you believe that to be the case, it will. In fact, I'll go at the other extreme and say, not every time you want the world to be different, will it be different. Doesn't work that way. But in the case of this woman, she turned to the right place after 12 years of it not changing, of 12 years of every hope being met with despair, of every power failing her. After all that time, she comes to a man and something actually results from her faith, her hope, and her action. So the text says in verse 29, and immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. The difference between this sort of action and the things we're used to in our world is stark. That Jesus does not offer her a prescription. Jesus isn't a physician in that sense. Jesus isn't a magician in that sense. He doesn't do an incantation. He doesn't say, let me show you. Let's draw the symbols on the ground and you pay the right price. And I mean, that's the difference, right? All the people she had seen before, for a small fee, I can give you something that doesn't work. Jesus, for free, gives her something that does. And what he gives her is himself. Jesus does not give her a cure. He is the cure. Jesus is not a physician, he is Lord. He is life and the incarnation of hope walking through the world and making things different. And she reaches out and touches him, and there is an immediate response in her life, unnoticed by others. Mark actually makes a big deal of the fact that other people didn't even know it had happened. If Jesus hadn't paused, and if Mark hadn't told us, no one would have known but her that this even took place. The text says, and Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And his disciples said to him, you see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, who touched me? They're confused by the question. First of all, the power had gone out from him is a little strange. I don't think it's trying to say Jesus is like a battery and he had discharged some power and suddenly he says, well, I'm only at 80% now of my miraculous power. I don't think that's what the story is trying to say. I think Jesus is like the sun, and wherever he goes, there's light. And Jesus had come into contact with the problem, and it had been fixed. In fact, if you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, wherever Jesus goes, stuff like this happened. In Luke's gospel, in the city of Nain, there's a widow whose son, her only son, had passed away, and they're carrying him out on a funeral bier, and Jesus reaches up and touches the body, and the son, he stands up. He gets up, and he's fine. Right? Jesus is just walking, talking power. It simply comes from him. He is aware of what he does, but it's entirely possible somebody else in the crowd wouldn't even know what had taken place. And so the disciples are just confused and confounded. They look and they say, not only can I not tell you who touched you, everyone touched you. It's a crowd. That's the definition of a crowd, is that everyone here was touching you as you passed by. Everyone here laid a hand on you. What do you mean, who touched me? They're mystified by the question. But of course, Jesus knows what's going on. And so in the text that follows, and he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. Again, watch the symmetry now. Two very different people. Jairus, Lord of the synagogue, powerful man with, same sort of desperation, but a different kind. Here is this woman, unnamed, unknown, 12 years of misery, both of them fall at the feet of Jesus. One coming in hope of a cure, one falls down because she had already received it. And she comes and she falls down at the feet, and she just opens up and tells him everything. She confesses the goodness he already knew to be true. And then Jesus pronounces on her these words in verse 34. He said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed from your disease. This is the only name she's given in the entire story, daughter. He views her in a way with tenderness and compassion that no one else had. Daughter. Same word used for the person we're on the road to see. Jairus had a daughter. Jesus says, this is someone's daughter. And he says that your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. That last bit, I think, is also important. Be healed of your disease. Hadn't he already healed her? How do you command someone who's been healed to be healed? Wouldn't that be fun if you went to the doctor and the doctor said, get better? You said, thanks, and you paid the bill. Jesus has healed her. He's actually done something. But then he says, go now and be healed. The Lord commands the healing and healed living. He doesn't just heal her. He says, I want you to go out and live as a healed person. I want you to go to the places you couldn't go before. I want you to do the things you had to stop doing. I want your life to be different. I am commanding you. This is the only command he gives her. Go out and live as a healed person and be at peace. Go take this blessing that's been given to you freely, given to you because of faith. In the next verse, we get back to the initial story. And Mark does it so beautifully. And while he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? So again, notice the storytelling. While Jesus is saying to this woman, daughter, your faith has made you well, at that exact moment, as he's saying those words, in comes the bad news. And Jairus, who might have thought this is just a distraction, right? Jesus stops in the middle of the crowd and says, who touched me? This is just, you know, an obscure abstraction. Jairus, who doesn't know what's going on, suddenly gets this earth-shattering news that everything is different now. The worst-case scenario, whatever despair might have left you of hope, is about to be ripped away. Your daughter also is dead. And now he has to make a decision about what he's going to do next. Jesus responds to it. He speaks to the woman. He overhears this conversation. And overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, do not fear, only believe. So you see how the two stories connect? At the very moment, Jairus was going to need a little extra dose of hope. At the very moment when he was going to have to make a decision about whether he wanted to hope or not, this miraculous transformation takes place that Jesus calls his attention to and says, look here, now believe. And Jairus then has this choice. Despair has come with news. Your daughter is dead. Remember, ancient people aren't great at medicine, I get that, but they understand dead. There's not really any reason to deny that she was dead. It's a fact, a grim part of the world. Jesus says, don't fear, just believe. The choice that he makes is what we call hope. I do believe hope is a choice. I don't think it's something that I can prescribe to you or give to you in a bottle. I think it is something you have to choose. It's the choice, is the world as bad as it seems forever? Or is it possible that there is a God who's actually Lord and can change the outcomes that I can't? Will I live my life and act as though the end has already been written and it's miserable? Or will I live my life as a person in the presence of the healer and act accordingly? Jairus makes a good decision. And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James, Jesus does, and John, his brother of James. And they came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping. They arrive, and they arrive in the full presence of despair. Of all kind of hope has been given up. The weeping, the mourning has already begun. The funeral planning is underway. And Jesus arrives, and he makes another pronouncement. And the commentators get distracted by this one because they want to know, what does this mean? Does Jesus mean that she's not actually dead? Maybe she's in some kind of coma or she's fainted or whatever. I don't think that's it. I really don't. Because, again, ancient people didn't know a lot about medicine. I feel pretty confident they knew what dead was. I think their pronouncement was, in all technical terms, accurate. They were mourning for good reason. They weren't just mistaken. But what Jesus says is that something else could be true. He is going to change reality. He's not saying, like naive person, oh, it's not as bad as you think. He's saying, I can make it different. There's a story told of an umpire from years gone by, the umpire, if you're a baseball fan, from years gone by, Bill Clem. He was the father of modern baseball officiating. He invented the safe and out sign, right? I mean, he's the guy. And it's way back when, and he's umpire behind the plate. And the story is told, maybe apocryphal, but the story is told, that the pitcher throws the pitch, and instead of calling strike or ball, Bill Clem just kind of stands there a while and kind of stares off into space. And eventually the opposing manager shouts and says, hey, it's either a ball or a strike, why don't you call it? And Bill Clem's famous response, it ain't nothing till I call it. And I think that's the significance of what Jesus is saying. She's either dead or alive, isn't she? I mean, it's kind of a binary choice. She's either dead or alive. It's one or the other. It ain't nothing till I say so. If Jesus says wake up, she'll wake up. If Jesus wants her to be alive, she'll be alive. It ain't nothing till I call it. Because you see, in a baseball game, the umpire is Lord. If he says it's a ball, it's a ball. You can yell, you can pick up and throw home plate at him, you can do whatever you want. He says it's a ball, it's a ball. In the universe, Jesus is Lord. And if he says wake up, that's exactly what she's going to do. And that's exactly what happens. Hope is believing that reality is whatever the Lord says it is. That what I see is not necessarily wrong, it's just not the final word. That what God chooses to make will be. The God who spoke the universe into existence is still speaking. In our life, despair, this is the most common expression. I mean, we hear it all the time. Finish the sentence. It is what it is. We know that one. It is what it is. It is what it is. What is that? That is a saying that the world is just the way it is and it can't be changed. Folks, with God, it is what it isn't. He decides what it is. And if he says, no, that dead girl's going to wake up, that's what happens. Hope is believing that reality is whatever the Lord says. And they laughed at him. And I understand why they laugh. Hope is kind of funny. Of course, they don't get the punchline. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was, and taking her by the hand, he said to her, Talitha kumi. Mark throws a little Aramaic in just for fun. Which means, little girl, I say to you, arise. Same words. Jairus had come and said, my little girl is at the point of death. Jesus said, your little girl is standing up. And she stood up. She got up and began walking. Hope is seeing Jesus as Lord over all, that the world will be as he says it is. Whatever you're facing in your life, I'm not telling you to be delusional. I'm not telling you to deny the power of evil in the world. I'm not telling you to ignore bad circumstances. What I'm telling you is that hope is believing that it's not over yet. The last page hasn't been written, and the author is the same good God who went to the cross to die on your behalf. That gives me some good feeling about how the story might end. Lots of things on the news can give you all kind of bad vibes about what's going on in the world. I don't quote Billy Graham a lot, but there was one great line from Billy Graham, and I'll end with that. He referenced the news of his day and bad tidings in the world, and he said, I've read the last page of the book, and it all ends okay. Folk, the Bible tells us that Jesus is Lord, and there's reason to hope in the outcome he creates more than the despair that I see every day. Bow with me in a word of prayer. Father, help us to hope. Help us to make the choice that the world is what you say it is, and that we can believe in that. Whether we are the rich man or the poor woman, whatever state of despair we find ourselves in, help us not to deny the world as we see it, but rather to recognize your power over it. And honoring you as Lord, fill us with hope. This we pray in the name of Jesus, Lord of hope. Amen.